socialism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, November 12th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Daniel Ellsberg on Obama's war in Afghanistan. A conversation with Deborah Pegler, who was freed after 27 years in prison for the murder of her abuser, plus Coal Country, a new documentary about coal mining and mountaintop removal.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. After months of meetings, President Barack Obama is expected to announce a decision to increase troop numbers in Afghanistan. There is some speculation as to how many troops he will add, but according to a senior military official quoted by the Wall Street Journal, a likely number is 30,000 to 35,000 extra U.S. troops. 10,000 of those could be used to train the Afghan National Army, with the idea of transferring military control to them eventually. However, the recent election debacle in Afghanistan has called into serious question the legitimacy of the central government and President Hamid Karzai, who's been implicated in serious counts of fraud. Further, Karzai's brother is a suspected drug lord and, according to the New York Times, receiving millions of dollars from the CIA. U.S. Ambassador Carl Eikenberry has reportedly urged Obama not to send any more troops until the central government regains credibility, according to news reports of a leaked cable transmission this morning. Matthew Ho, a former Marine Corps captain, recently became the first known U.S. official to resign over his opposition to the Afghan war. In stepping down from his foreign service position in Zabul province, Ho publicly expressed his frustrations that the war was viewed by most Afghans as an unwelcome occupation. Ho's statements are reminiscent of a man who most famously went public over his opposition to a similar war more than 35 years ago. Daniel Ellsberg, a former U.S. military analyst who leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War. Ellsberg is now one of Afghanistan war's most fervent critics, and he's going to be speaking at an event in Los Angeles this evening. He now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Daniel.
Good to be here. Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Daniel, when I last saw you, which was just a little over a month and a half ago, you were here in Los Angeles talking about the film that is based on your life, The Most Dangerous Man in America. And you at that time said that you had some respect for President Obama because he was taking his time, it seemed, to think about all of the various options, that he was being patient, that he was potentially troubled by what was happening in Afghanistan and potentially might actually do the right thing. Do you feel differently now?
I feel more hopeful this morning than I have for a long time because of the news that you mentioned this morning of Ambassador Eikenberry, Eikenberry, just looking at here, not a familiar name to me till now, but I hope he'll get to be very familiar. For instance, I hadn't realized that the current ambassador to Afghanistan had been in charge of military operations there and that he's a lieutenant general. In other words, that he can speak with as much, if not more, authority from a military point of view on the situation than General McChrystal.
So he's unlike other ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors to other countries?
Well, most ambassadors, of course, are civilians. In fact, it's fairly rare for a general to be an ambassador. And in this case, he was a general, as I say, in charge of operations in that country. I'm not sure I do know of an analogy to that. It's quite unusual. So the point is that when he speaks on military proposals, as he is saying no more troops now, his advice has the same military weight, at least, as General Petraeus or General McChrystal. And it sounds to me much, much more sensible. Something that encourages me also is that I believe he may well have been influenced by speaking very bluntly to the president and cogently by the example of his former subordinate, Matthew Ho, who was, as a foreign service officer and a senior officer in one of his most difficult provinces, districts, who resigned, of course, a few weeks ago and came public. Now, it was put out at the time that he was so well regarded, Ho, H-O-H, that Ambassador Eikenberry offered him a job on his own staff if he would stay in the embassy, which he turned down. And then the plenipotentiary, Richard Holbrooke, who was in charge ambassador for Iraq and Afghanistan, Pakistan, I guess, not Iraq, but Pakistan and Afghanistan, over the other Foreign Service people, offered him a job in his staff, Holbrooke's staff in Washington, which he accepted for about a week, and then turned it down in order to be able to speak freely and independently. Now, obviously, Ho was not only known to Eikenberry, who wanted him to stay, but did have interaction with Eikenberry before he left. Eikenberry offered him a job. I read into that that Eikenberry met somebody who was giving up his career in order to tell the truth to the country and to the Congress as well as to the president, and may well have been encouraged to do the same. Now, if if the two of them together could encourage one, two, three, or four more people to do that, I think we'd have a breaking in the dam here that would allow us to really appreciate the realities of Afghanistan, what the real options are, and do what both Eikenberry and Ho are calling for. In the case of Eikenberry, to hold the line pretty much where we are. Ho was calling for an actual reduction. But we are now hearing that a fourth option has joined the three we've been hearing about for about a week now in the White House. And the three were 20, all in levels, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000. And the unspoken number was the 80, 85,000 that McChrystal is now known to have asked as his favorite option, if he could get it, the low-risk option. So when we heard about a fourth option, I must say my first reaction was, yeah, you know, 80,000. It seems now, as of today's news, that the fourth option is leaked to maybe 10,000, which will be not combat troops, but to train the Afghan army. Very much, by the way, what Joe Biden, the vice president, seems to have been calling for right along. So theoretically, Biden's proposal, which was put off the table by McChrystal's lobbying against it, he lobbied against it even at NATO headquarters in what looked very like insubordination, something like Douglas MacArthur's going around the president in the Korean War, for which MacArthur was fired. Hard to fire McChrystal right now, although, in my opinion, desirable, but hard to do that when he had when Obama himself had appointed him and had endorsed his strategy earlier. But there were rumors that McChrystal would resign if he didn't get very close to the minimum he was asking, and the minimum was 40,000, not 20,000 or 30,000.
Now, on the issue of the Biden proposal that you just mentioned, the other part of his proposal, in addition to having, you know, a smaller number, 10,000 troops to help train the Afghan National Army, was the increasing reliance on unmanned drones to more heavily expand the war in the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I suppose we don't really know details of what's being really discussed, but I'm wondering if you think that we might be a little premature in being hopeful about the smaller number of troops now being considered, because they may just expand the war elsewhere.
Now, as of now, stopping those drone attacks, which I and analysts that I respect regard as necessary, as urgent, is not on the table, quote. And we've heard of none of the participants in the government or in Congress have urged that. Why do I urge that? Because from everything we have heard reported, there's every reason to believe that it builds more recruits for the Taliban and for al-Qaeda even than can possibly be, quote, eliminated or neutralized by the drone attacks. In killing the civilians and in putting virtually all the civilians under threat, hour by hour, as these drones hover over them visibly in the sky, not knowing which wedding party will receive the next rocket, or which funeral party after the first rocket attack will be itself attacked. That kind of anxiety and fury and rage of the victims and the people terrorized by that is the most fertile possible recruiting grounds for the Taliban. So it seems to me a totally feckless policy, although I can perfectly well hear the arguments that are made for it. It's killing some Taliban leaders, and what else are we doing that does that? So they talk about it as the only productive approach, ignoring the fact that not just in the long run, but in the short run, It's hurting us very badly. Now, when I say that, then, I say I'm criticizing part of Biden's proposal and what is likely to happen. But given that the president is virtually sure to continue those attacks, unfortunately, right now, then is 10,000 better than 40,000 or 30,000 or 20,000 additional troops? Yes, I say that definitely. So it's less of a commitment. It keeps the possibility open for another part, by the way, of of all people, Karzai's program. Corrupt as he is and involved heavily in the dope trade as he is, he has been calling for negotiations with the Taliban. Now, that wasn't on the table, you can be sure, until very recently, if it is at all. Now, is that really conceivable? Yes. He dealt with the Taliban when he was representing oil companies and trying to get a pipeline through Afghanistan earlier, his earlier life. So he undoubtedly knows a number of their leaders, and he calls them brothers. He recognizes them as brother Afghans. He's a Pashtun himself, which is where the Taliban is based. I would say that a combination of 10,000 troops, which is now leaked, to, quote, train the Afghan army, which has no prospect of success whatever, but is better than sending the troops into the countryside to kill Afghans and be killed themselves, could be combined with a negotiating approach here, which would have a real prospect of getting us out of there.
I'm speaking with Daniel Ellsberg, the famed dissenter during the Vietnam War who leaked the Pentagon Papers. A new film about him was just released this year, The Most Dangerous Man in America. He's now one of the Afghanistan War's most important critics, and he's going to be speaking tonight at an event organized by the Brave New Foundation. It's happening in Venice at the Venice United Methodist Church. And in fact, Matthew Ho, the Foreign Service officer who recently resigned that we've just been discussing as well, will also be present and on a panel alongside Daniel Ellsberg and Robert Greenwald, the producer, director, and political activist, founder, and president of Brave New Foundation, whose film Rethink Afghanistan has also been making waves. I'll be joining the panel too, and that's happening tonight at 7:30 p.m. There's going to be a screening of the film and a guest panel with all of these panelists. There'll be a reception at 6:30 p.m. That's the Venice United Methodist Church, 1020 Victoria Avenue in Venice. And to RSVP, you can just simply email rsvp@bravenewfoundation.org. That's rsvp@bravenewfoundation.org. Now, I want to take you up on this point that you just made, Daniel, briefly before we end our conversation, which is the issue of negotiations with the Taliban. And in fact, Karzai had been negotiating with the Taliban, and there is a member of the parliament who is a Taliban leader. There are many Taliban-like figures in the government, and it seems to me as though it doesn't seem quite a bit of a victory from grassroots activist perspective to have a Taliban-dominated government installed in Afghanistan, enabling us to leave, because it seems as though for the past 8 years, all we've done is create a government of fundamentalists and Taliban-like, as well as actual Taliban leaders. So why should that be considered a victory from the perspective of peace-loving Americans and Afghans?
Well, first of all, a victory for Americans is to withdraw, extricate ourselves from military involvement in the affairs of, really, not only of Afghanistan, but I would say of Iraq and Pakistan as well. That brings us no good, and it hasn't brought much good for the people of that area. But the Taliban, to start with, as far as I can see, have never posed a security threat to the United States. The sanctuary that they offered to Al-Qaeda was certainly opportunistic and convenient for Al-Qaeda, not essential, as we're seeing right now. Al-Qaeda is no longer there, and there are many other places they could be, and they don't operate from a headquarters very much. We keep hearing that in Afghanistan, the 9/11 attacks were planned. Well, actually not. They were okayed by Osama bin Laden, who was at that time in Afghanistan. The planning was done elsewhere, as it would be in the future, and it's being done elsewhere. And the implementation and the training was done elsewhere. The training camps did not provide the hijackers, for example, training camps in Afghanistan. So the Taliban, who, the question is, can they be bargained with? Can they be negotiated with to prevent a return of al-Qaeda to that country? I am no judge of that, but others who know the region much better say yes, that's quite possible, that there's no, that the statements that, of course, al-Qaeda will return if we're not there by Hillary Clinton are not well-founded at all. But in any case, and even if that were the case, as Paul Pillar has pointed out, the CIA analyst for that area, even a base in Afghanistan of some sort would not be any critical addition to al-Qaeda's capabilities, and denying it is not any critical blow to them. It's not the issue that it's been described. So on terms of the Taliban, when we're talking about negotiating with the Taliban, that doesn't mean negotiating with the and giving them full power or even a major part of power. It probably means some kind of coalition where they're represented in the government. The Pashtun, as I understand it, have felt excluded a good deal in the cities. But their strength of the Taliban, which is largely a rural Pashtun area, as Matthew Ho has pointed out very, very well, by the way, is not in the cities. And they didn't really have the capability of taking the cities after the Soviets.
Well, but you're saying that the Taliban would like to be represented in the government. Ordinary Afghans would also like to be represented in the government. And I think at this point you have to sort of choose between one or the other because the Taliban won't let ordinary Afghans, and neither will the warlords in the government.
Yes. Look, you're familiar, I'm sure, with the position of Malalai Joya, who points out that ordinary Afghanis are oppressed by three oppressors, the American invaders, the Taliban, and the warlords. And her desire to get the Americans out of there is to say that's one less oppressive force for us to have to deal with. The other two being being Afghan, whatever their merits and demerits. And they both have a lot, the warlords and the Taliban. I haven't seen any American statesman who's shown an ability to arrange matters in Afghanistan for the benefit of Afghanis, and you can be sure that's not a high priority for them.
Right.
Why imperialism, trying to govern a place that of a different color, religion, ethnic background, and language from thousands of miles away, is not a good idea, and there's no future in it.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, we'll have to continue our conversation tonight. I look forward to seeing you at the panel.
Okay. Very good. Good to see you tonight, Sonali. The reason I'm very happy to come is to meet Matthew Ho.
Absolutely.
For him.
Daniel Ellsberg has been my guest, and he's going to be on a guest panel tonight alongside Matthew Ho, the recently resigned Foreign Service officer who resigned in protest of the Afghanistan occupation. Robert Greenwald will be on the panel, as will I, and there's going to be a screening of Rethink Afghanistan, and also that is all happening at Venice United Methodist Church, 1020 Victoria Avenue in Venice. And it's happening at 7:30 p.m. There's also a reception at 6:30 p.m. And to RSVP, just email rsvp@bravenewfoundation.org. There is a donation to enter that includes a copy of the film. Again, you can find out more by emailing rsvp@bravenewfoundation.org. And we'll list this information on our website later today as well at kpfk.org. Later in the hour, Coal Country, a new documentary about coal mining and mountaintop removal in West Virginia. And after today's Subversive Historian, part one of a two-part interview with Debbie Piegler, a formerly incarcerated victim of violence, speaking out on behalf of women everywhere. Stay tuned.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your Subversive Historian. Back in the day, on November 12, 1893, the Durand Line Agreement was signed between Afghan Amir Abdur Rahman and British colonial officer Henry Mortimer Durand. The seven articles of agreement were signed in Kabul and set a 1,519-mile line of demarcation between Afghanistan and British colonial India. The Durand Line was imposed over the objections of most Afghans as Rahman was promised a subsidy in return for his support. Sir Henry certainly held the memory of two Anglo-Afghan wars that had taken place in the 19th century close in mind. The arbitrary border split the unconquerable Pashtun peoples apart. It became a source of dissension between the Afghan and newly independent Pakistani governments throughout the 20th century. The Durand Line today represents a vastly underreported angle in the U.S. war in Afghanistan. The colonial legacy of British borders remain as open wounds as the colonizing knife of history is passed on. For Uprising, this is your truth, Professor, saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history. Project Sweatshop, in association with Grassroots Productions, present an inspiring celebration of consciousness and humanity. The 4th annual We the People Music and Arts Festival, featuring DJ and festival ambassador Will I Am of the Black Eyed Peas. Also performing Bad Religion, Suicidal Tendencies, Pepper, The Flowbots, Mad Villain, Spraga Benz, Tumex, and much more. The annual Art is a Hammer exhibit will also be on hand. It all takes place at Los Angeles Center Studios in downtown Los Angeles at 450 South Bixel Street. That's Saturday, November 21st. Doors open at 2 p.m. for the whole family. More information is available at 213-702-0265. Again, that's 213-702-0265. Or go to kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
Hi, I'm Arundhati Roy, and you're listening to Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
Following up from our coverage earlier this week of violence against women globally with Jordanian journalist Rana Hosseini, we focus today and tomorrow on violence against American women through the case of one victim of domestic violence, Debbie Pegler. In 1982, a man by the name of Oliver Wilson was found dead. Among those arrested for his murder was his former girlfriend, Deborah Pegler, who was convicted of first-degree murder and 25 years to life in prison. Pegler had been horrifically abused and tortured by Wilson, forced into prostitution, and had her daughter molested. She turned to two men to help free her from his grasp. After serving 27 years in prison, Debbie, through the hard work of pro bono lawyers and a lot of public support and media attention, finally won her freedom this past August. There is now a growing recognition that abused women who attack or kill their batterers ought to be given special consideration. However, many women continue to be punished for attempting to defend themselves from abuse. A case in point is the story of Sarah Cruzan from Riverside, California, reported in alternate.org, who was sentenced to life in prison for killing her pimp, a man who raped her and then forced her to work the streets since she was a 13-year-old child. Today, despite an ongoing battle with cancer, Deborah Pegler is a free woman and carrying out her own crusade to bring attention to victims of domestic violence. There's a film being made about her as well called From Crime to Crime. I spoke with her recently. Today we play you part one of our two-part interview with Deborah Pegler as well as Yoav Potash, the filmmaker. Debbie, how did you view your case during the time you were in prison from the point of view of what is considered a crime and what is considered a punishment for a crime?
I just felt like trapped, like there was no one there to hear my side of the story or to take in consideration, you know, the whys. They were just dealing with the facts of what happened. You know, the actual crime itself, not looking at the mitigating circumstances behind the crime. And that's what really hurt me.
Did your own perception of what happened to you and what you did change over time while you were in prison?
Definitely. At the onset, because I was not the actual perpetrator of my crime, mm-hmm. I felt like, you know, I had been dealt with unjustly and unfairly because I did not, you know, commit the crime myself. And for a long time, I was in that place that, you know, what I've come to realize was really just denial. Because had not my actions been what they were, decisions that I made, you know, he would still be alive. So I had to come to terms with that and really accept the fact that, you know, this man's life was taken because of me.
But then how did your own views about what happened to you evolve and understanding your own actions evolve?
It wasn't until I got involved with the domestic violence, the battered women's support group there at the prison, that I really even acknowledged the fact that, you know, I was a battered woman. You know, I just thought that was just a lifestyle and that was how I found myself living. You know, that was just life. You know, I didn't know that what was happening to me was not supposed to happen because, you know, I grew up watching my mother be beaten. So I thought it was the norm. It wasn't anything abnormal to me. You know,
how did you react and how do you react when people say, well, if you're being beaten by a man, why don't you just leave?
Because it's not that easy. You know, this person has convinced you that you have no self-worth, you have no self-value, that you're nothing without them. And, you know, on top of that, there are many threats, you know, threats. If you left them, if they will kill your family, they'll kill you, they'll kill themselves. And you come to believe that.
When you were in prison, did you meet a lot of women like yourself who were in similar positions as yourself?
Definitely. The majority of the women that are there serving life sentences are there for killing their better, you know, or a partner, boyfriend. And especially when I got involved with the support group, and I came to see that there was a family of us. You know, we became a family. There was many women. You know, out of the 4,000 women there, I would say one-third of them were battered women.
One-third of them?
Yes.
And a good portion of them perhaps were in prison because they tried to fight back? And
yes.
And how much of what they go through you think is understood by people on the outside, if you will?
Very little. Very little. I've come to realize that people really don't understand, you know, the plight of the battered woman. I mean, the person that's been a victim of domestic violence, they don't understand. You know, the main thing they say is, you know, why didn't you leave? Why didn't you leave? And they don't understand that that's like, you come to believe that it's impossible. There's no way out. You become like a trapped animal.
Now, California is fairly unique in the country, I understand, in that it enabled you, the state's laws changed in a way that enabled you to be able to be free today because in part of this recognition that there should be special consideration for women who are victims of domestic violence. Can you tell us a little bit about how so much of what is, that we understand to be our justice system affects the lives of women like you?
Yes, thank God for this new law that give the women a voice. They give us a voice now, and we can be heard.
It's a habeas law?
Yes, the habeas project, 1473B. And it now allows you to submit a writ, you know, in detailing your experience and your evidence of the battered woman syndrome or, you know, domestic violence now. They're terming it. And, you know, it's helped so many women get out of prison. And give them a voice.
Yoav, I want to bring you into the conversation. You're a filmmaker who is documenting this story, and you have been documenting it as it was unfolding, even while Debbie was in prison. How did you come to be involved in this story, and why did you think that this was something important to cover?
I heard about Deborah's case from one of her attorneys, Joshua Saffron, and in terms of my initial interest was, I think, just the stakes are so high. There's someone in prison for life. There's attorneys working pro bono to get her out. And the odds are against her in terms of once someone is in prison, once they're convicted, once they're sentenced, the whole legal system is a huge uphill battle to try to get anyone under those circumstances out of prison. And I initially just agreed, okay, I'll meet Debbie. I don't know anything about her. And, you know, to be honest, I think I had some of the preconceived notions that, or at least just fears that anyone would have about someone who's in prison for murder. And I figured, well, I'll meet her, but I don't know if I'm going to believe her story. I don't know if I'm going to be open to her as a person. But once I did meet her, and film her, I felt like, okay, I'm hooked. as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, I was very curious to know more. I was very curious to see how things would evolve. And at that point, I knew something that even Debbie didn't know, which was that the district attorney of Los Angeles had put a deal in writing saying that she was about to be released.
But then that deal kind of had a bit of a snag in it, which your film also details. Tell us a little bit about the sort of ways in which there were moments of hope and then so many setbacks in this battle to get Debbie out of prison, and then I'll get Debbie's reaction to that too.
So after about three or four years of investigative work by Debbie's attorneys, they had found a number of people who verified Debbie's side of the story. that she was abused pretty horrifically, that she was coerced into prostitution, and that she had little way to escape, that there were death threats made against her and her family. And once her story was corroborated, her attorneys, who normally are land use attorneys, decided that they would sort of apply a principle that they normally practice in land use law, which is before you go before the city commission to try to get some project passed, you know, find out what the other side thinks and get them on your side. So they went to the district attorney, who could choose to oppose her release, and they said, look at all of our facts. Look at everything that wasn't presented back in 1983 when you prosecuted this woman and when you threatened to pursue the death penalty against her. She was a victim of domestic violence, and we believe she should be set free now. We believe that her crime, if she committed a crime, was not murder, was maybe manslaughter or something along those lines, where she did know that Oliver Wilson was going to come into some harm. But it was different than it had been laid out in court. And the district attorney reviewed everything that was presented to them, as well as their own files, which Debbie's attorneys were not privy to. And the district attorney, Steve Cooley, put a deal in writing that said, we're going to cooperate, we agree, we're going to retroactively change our accusation from first-degree murder to manslaughter, which means her maximum sentence would have been 6 years, which means Debbie is going to be set free because she has over-served her sentence by, you know, many, many years. And that was the deal that was put in writing, that was presented to her. And unfortunately, once that deal was revealed to Debbie and was revealed to some people within the district attorney's office who hadn't known about it before, the district attorney decided to withdraw from that deal, or at least to attempt to withdraw from the deal, which, because it was sort of legally questionable if they could withdraw from a deal after offering it to her legal team and to her herself. So everything became a wild roller coaster ride, from everyone believing Debbie was about to be set free to it now becoming a real mess and something that got in the media and turned into a potential lawsuit against the district attorney and made Debbie and her legal team continue to have to fight for several years before we knew what the outcome would be.
And Debbie, what was that like to sort of see the hope and then to lose that hope, and to have to just deal with that, just given the stakes involved, given the chance to see your family, your children, and then feel, you know, to have that snatched away?
I was so excited. It was kind of unbelievable that finally I was going to be free, that finally someone had hurt me, that someone had not only hurt me but believed me, because of the amount and the kind of violence that I suffered. You know, it was kind of unbelievable. And I finally had someone to believe me and to believe in me, and to hear that the district attorney's office was willing to allow me to be free. I was so excited, and I went back, you know, to the housing unit where I lived, and had given all my property away, had given my clothes away, and I was really preparing myself for freedom. I was free all except for being physically, mentally and emotionally, I had freed myself from that place. And when I found out that the deal had been taken away, that was one of the hardest things I've had to deal with during my incarceration, to bring myself back into the prison and to re-imprison myself. You know, it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do.
And so then what happened, and how long was it until you were finally freed?
That deal was offered in 2005. I wasn't freed until August 22nd of 2009.
So just a few months ago.
Yes.
While you were in prison, you were diagnosed with cancer.
Yes.
What has that added to the dimensions of your life?
I when I was diagnosed in February of 2009, I couldn't believe it. It's like everything I've suffered and everything I've been through, and now this. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, I went through the, you know, I don't deserve this, and why me? And, you know, I was so angry. You know, I was angry at God. I was just angry at life. I felt like, you know, I didn't deserve this. I didn't deserve any more pain and suffering. I suffered enough. And they told me I had stage 4 and they'd given me 6 months to live. So I was like, oh my God, now on top of everything else, I'm going to die in prison. And I just, it was devastating.
But you're here.
But I'm here. But I'm here because of my faith in God. I'm here.
What was it like to see your daughters again?
Oh my goodness. You know, I've had opportunity to visit with them like every few years because they both live out of state. But now being able, my youngest daughter moved to California permanently to be with me. Mm-hmm. And so I've had an opportunity just to be with her and my grandchildren. You know, my granddaughter is one, so I haven't been around a baby in, you know, almost 30 years. So that was a transition. That was an adjustment period in itself, you know, being around a baby. But it's been the highlight of my life, just being around them. Just, you know, unlimited time, you know, no restrictions. I can just be with them whenever I want to now. And it's wonderful.
How prevalent do you think domestic violence is in our country, in our culture? I mean, not just in prison among the women that you were able to meet with in your support group, but just in general in the U.S., and how invisible is it?
It's, you know, there's more attention coming, being focused on it now, you know, thank God, but it's so prevalent. You know, it's happening in so many homes, and there's so many women still today in that place of hopelessness and helplessness. You know, even though we have the shelters and we have organizations now to help us, but the women are even afraid to ask for help. These men have you afraid to ask for help because you really feel trapped. You feel like there's no way out.
What could have helped you before the tragic events that set off the death of Oliver Wilson? What could, do you think, what could our society have had in place in terms of resources to help women like you before something really bad happens?
I think law enforcement could have been more active because the police was called out, mm-hmm. you know, and when Oliver came to my mother's house where I was living, I had been separated from him, you know, got out of the house, thankfully, but, you know, he became, you know, what's known today as a stalker. You know, had maybe those laws been on the books, you know, law enforcement could have really helped me and helped keep him away from me.
You mean having somebody, having a restraining order,
yes.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, but one that actually works because the restraining order, you know, it really doesn't help. Because if they aren't actively doing anything to you, the police won't even come. Even though you have a restraining order, you know, it's supposed to keep them so many feet away or keep them away from you. If you call the police and say he's across the street, well, what is he doing? He's just sitting there. Well, they're not going to come out for that.
And Oliver was arrested but then released very shortly.
Yes.
At a time before... when you were trying to get away from him, essentially.
Yes.
And it's interesting, you know, we use these words domestic violence, Debbie, but those words are vague.
Mm-hmm.
They're not specific. I mean, what was done to you was, you know, far worse than I think, you know, most of us can imagine, not only to you, to your daughter as well. How much awareness do you think has there been among our society about how severe domestic violence is and what more needs to be done? I mean, what really needs to be done, you think, in order for people to understand that domestic violence is among the worst forms of violence to anybody?
I think a lot more education. You know, a lot more information needs to be out there. And a lot more people that are involved in the shelters now that have gotten out and in the shelters can be interviewed and their voices being heard, you know, and their experiences shared with more people. Because domestic violence, you know, it's a nice title. But they don't understand the violence and the suffering and the pain and the anguish that's experienced by the women.
That's the voice of Debbie Pegler, formerly incarcerated victim of domestic violence. She was just released this past August, and I spoke with her recently alongside Yoav Potash, who's a filmmaker. He's making a film about her. And you can listen to part two of this interview tomorrow. I spoke with them for an extended interview. Today was part one, tomorrow part two. If you missed this, visit our website at kpfk.org/uprising after 10 a.m. today. After this short music break, Coal Country. We'll speak with a filmmaker. Stay tuned. A documentary by Phyllis Geller and Mary Lynn Evans explores the economic and environmental devastation of extracting coal through mountaintop removal, or MTR, in the Coal River Mountain region of West Virginia. Also known as strip mining, mountaintop removal is a process of clear-cutting forest from mountains, blasting away the unwanted rock, extracting the coal, and dumping the debris into local valleys and stream beds. Those living near mountaintop removal sites endure having their groundwater wells polluted by coal, and high rates of cancer and other diseases. Coal Country exposes how coal companies have stifled diverse economic development in West Virginia in order to maintain their influence as the main job provider. MTR is more profitable than underground mining, which requires more miners. But coal companies still like to say they are the main source of jobs and that, quote, coal keeps the lights on. The PR battle is shaping up. 2 weeks ago, the biggest coal company in West Virginia, Massey Energy Company, resumed blasting in Coal River Mountain. And on October 30th, Appalachian climate justice activists protested in Washington, D.C., staging sit-ins and zombie marches at the offices of the EPA and J.P. Morgan Chase, one of Big Coal's biggest bankrollers, along with Citigroup. My guests are Phyllis Geller, the writer and director, and Mary Lynn Evans, the executive producer of Coal Country. They join me in studio. There's going to be a premiere of their film tonight in Los Angeles at the Grammy Museum. Welcome to Uprising, Phyllis and Mary Lynn.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. We just heard a song that is part of the companion CD that's featured alongside that is part of this documentary. The film will also be airing starting November 14th at 5 p.m. Pacific time on the digital cable network Planet Green. Let's talk first about this whole concept of mountaintop removal, which I think is a more accurate term than some other terms that are often used. We've covered this issue on our program before, but is this method of coal extraction literally exactly that, removing whole mountaintops? Phyllis?
Well, the people in the coal industry will call it mountaintop mining, mm-hmm. and as you said, use different terms, but the people who are so opposed to it call it mountaintop removal. When you see it, it is like looking at the moon. You feel like you're in a war zone, like you're seeing bombed out shell. Because the top of the mountain is flattened. They have to flatten it in order to get to the coal. Now, they talk about reclaiming. They talk about planting some green on top and possibly using it for other, you know, to build airports and buildings, shopping malls. But that really hasn't happened. And, in fact, once you cut off the top of the mountain, it's gone forever. And that's what's happening down there.
Mm-hmm. So is it, however, just a matter then of marring the natural beauty of these mountains, or is it a lot more than that?
It's so much more than that. I grew up in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. My brother is a coal miner. So I understand the economics of living down there and living in this mono economy where either you work for King Coal or you work for a minimum wage or you have to leave the state. But what's happened with this mining is it is not just that aesthetically it's destroying the Appalachian Mountains. Because once you blast those mountains, once you dump that debris down into those little hollers and you poison the water, those communities disappear forever. People have to leave because they can no longer live in those communities. And what's happening is an end to the entire Appalachian mountain culture as we knew it. The music, the language, the heritage that we have as Appalachian people is being blasted away by these coal companies just as much as the mountains are.
And yet the coal companies say that they are actually the source of the main source of jobs, that it is because of them that there's this industry in the first place, which has led to this culture.
Well, the job issue is an extremely important issue, and nobody is saying that the people working in coal should be put out of work tomorrow. There has to be a transition into sustainable, renewable energy that will create jobs, that will create green jobs. But in the meantime, as Mary Lynn said, what this type of mining does is destroy an entire ecosystem, all the flora and the fauna, as well as the aesthetic beauty, and endanger the health of the humans. Mm-hmm.
The water issue is a big one. From watching your film, I think, learned for the first time that much of this, in addition to, of course, coal being such a dirty fuel and leading to the problems of global warming, that's the obvious environmental disaster. But then there's also the issue of water. How does mountaintop removal pollute the waters, not only in the regions of West Virginia, but where those rivers flow?
Exactly. And, you know, what's happening is, with all the explosives and all the chemicals that are used to process this, you know, there are also hundreds of slurry dams, which are just filled with processing chemicals that are all over West Virginia, Kentucky, other parts of the Appalachian region. And that's getting into these water systems. And what you're finding is people in these little communities are suffering at high rates of brain tumors, leukemia, other types of cancers that you don't see in other places within the region. I think the estimate is something around over 500 more deaths are experienced in the coal fields than in other regions of the area, and the only thing that it can be attributed to is the coal mining process.
Phyllis?
I wanted to add that what we try to do in the film is look at the whole process of coal from extraction, because you have to look at it, as they say, from the cradle to the grave. What does it take to pull it out of the ground? That's the mining side. Then the processing with the cleaning and all the waste that comes from that. Then the burning. And that's where all the pollutants go into the air. So every step along the way is a problem.
So it seems as though there's so many intersectioning issues at stake here. And of course, the biggest significance of all of this is that the United States gets what, half its electricity from
almost
coal?
Half.
And West Virginia is one of the sort of epicenters of that. And you have here the issue of labor rights.
Absolutely.
You have the issue of the economy, and you have the issue of the environment. And who's benefiting from from all of this are big coal companies like Massey Energy. What about government? What about the two senators of West Virginia? What is the role of Senators Rockefeller and Byrd, I believe, are the two senators?
It's a really sad situation. Senator Rockefeller, when he originally came to West Virginia as a Vista worker in the early 1970s, was opposed to strip mining and lost his election for governor. And after that happened, he became a supporter of coal. And Senator Byrd, still to this day, has been supportive of the coal industry as this is the only job in town. But what has happened during that time is in the early 1960s, there were over 150,000 coal mining jobs in West Virginia alone. Today, there are about 15,000 coal mining jobs in West Virginia. And of those, only 3,500 are directly related to mountaintop removal mining. This mining is being done not to provide jobs, not to support the economy of these regions, but for the benefit of these coal companies, many of which are incorporated outside of the region in St. Louis, Philadelphia, other areas like this.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Mary Lynn Evans, the executive producer of Coal Country, and Phyllis Geller, the writer and director. Their film is called Coal Country, and it's screening at the Grammy Museum tonight, 800 West Olympic Boulevard. You have to RSVP, and I understand there's a few seats left, and you can do that online at earthjustice.org/MTR, earthjustice.org/MTR, or you can watch it on Planet Green, the digital cable network, starting November 14th at 5 p.m. Pacific time. I want to play an excerpt of the film Coal Country, featuring the woman Judy Bonds, who is one of the sort of heroes of this story, if you will. And in this excerpt from Coal Country, she touches on this issue of poverty and the economy of West Virginia. Here's Coal Country.
It's a sad situation that people are in here. Very sad. You can look at statistics, and statistically, the poorest parts of Appalachia, particularly in West Virginia, are the coal-producing counties. Why? Why are we so poor? I watch millions and millions of dollars worth of coal and timber drive right by my home every day. Why are we so poor? Why are our towns ghost towns? Why is Welch and McDowell County the poorest county in the United States? But then you go to towns that have no coal, that have no mining. Tourism, places where there's tourism, is the most beautiful place there is. They're booming. They're booming. Whitewater rafting, camping, fishing, canoeing. We could have that here. Our area here is as beautiful as any place in West Virginia that you want to go. But the difference is they're blowing up the mountains and they're covering up the streams. There's ugly black goo all over our communities because of coal mining. And it'll be that way for a very long time. And I do believe there'll be a wall of fame and a wall of shame. And I believe that those that allowed this to happen will go down in history on the wall of shame. And our kids are going to ask us, what the hell were you thinking? Why didn't you do something? These students want to be known as the Green Generation, and they are definitely making a statement.
One of the biggest financial contributors, actually, to global warming around the world and to climate change here is actually Citigroup. Every time there's a new coal plant that wants to start, they need capital, they need funding, and Citigroup is one of the biggest contributors to that.
And that's an excerpt from the documentary Coal Country. We heard the voice of Judy Bonds. And it's a story not only of how coal mining and mountaintop removal has devastated the region of West Virginia, but also of the very successful struggles and resistance of, it seems, mostly women. And the two filmmakers of this documentary joining me in studio, also very strong women, Phyllis Geller and Mary Lynn Evans. Let's talk about Judy Bonds and some of these other, I mean, there's several women, including Judy, who are leaders in the sort of grassroots, almost uprising that is fomented in the West Virginia area of Coal River Mountain.
Judy Bonds makes me proud to be a hillbilly. She really does. I met Judy when Phyllis and I were making a PBS series, The Appalachians, and Judy was the first person to show me mountaintop removal mining. And she is so inspirational. These people, including Judy, have formed these small not-for-profit groups and have really taken on the coal industry and have forced them to contend with, you know, their concerns and are really out there speaking and have really formed a national movement. And as Judy says, you know, this is not just about the environment, environmental rights. It's about civil rights for people in Appalachia.
And so in the last few minutes of our conversation here, let's talk about what lies in the future of this movement. I mean, coal is still king, and people like Judy are still fighting. What do you, Phyllis, what do you hope your documentary will do in all of this, this sort of battle between these two forces, if you will, and what's coming up on the horizon for listeners to pay attention to?
Well, our goal, of course, is to bring the story to more and more people, to a general public, because it needs to hit at a national level for everybody to get involved. One very sad thing, what Judy Bonds and her people at Coal River Mountain Watch have been trying to do is push to create a wind farm on Coal River Mountain. Now, in your intro, you mentioned that Massey had started blasting Coal River Mountain. That was the last mountain in its range that was left pristine. Mm-hmm. And for the past 3 weeks, they've been blasting. So it's
happening
very,
as we speak.
And the hope for the wind farm was to create jobs, to create green jobs, to offer an alternative instead of blasting that mountain. So they're in the midst of a huge mess right now. And we're hoping that, that people will pay attention and go to these websites, find out how you can help. You can go to the Sierra Club, our partners for our outreach efforts, our Sierra Club and Earth Justice. There are huge efforts going on in different communities, and there's something you can do.
And earthjustice.org/MTR is also where you can find out about the documentary Coal Country we've just been discussing. You can also RSVP there for the screening tonight at the Grammy Museum, 800 West Olympic Boulevard in L.A. You have to RSVP. There's a few seats left, and if you don't get to watch it tonight, it'll be on the digital cable network, Planet Green, starting November 14th at 5 p.m. Phyllis Geller, the writer and director, Mary Lynn Evans, executive producer of Coal Country. Thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Daniel Quinn once said, "We've poured our poisons into the world as though it were a bottomless pit, and we go on gobbling them up. It's hard to imagine how the world could survive another century of this abuse." That's Daniel Quinn. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. today on our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.